Good evening. Thank you for being here. I've mentioned numerous times in the context of sermons like this that the technical problems are all my fault, and most of the time they are. It ought to be relatively obvious that the typos are my fault. Fortunately, we managed to corral that situation, and unfortunately, we'll never get a chance to know whether Brandon would have actually read all the way through chapter 17 of 1 Kings, probably just as well. All right. Are you a pragmatist or are you an ideologue or ideologue? You may be saying, well, that depends on what those words mean. Well, we'll discuss that a little bit as we go. This is actually a long-standing philosophical discussion among people. In the modern day, in the current climate, actually, it's generally seen in a political kind of discussion, but it's not a political conversation necessarily. It just kind of depends. Basically, a pragmatist is somebody who gets things done. It's somebody who is results-oriented more than anything else. And we'll define the terms a little bit more specifically as we go along. An ideologue is someone who is policy-driven, someone who is a theorist, you might say. Someone who is more interested in a procedure than he is in results. And they both have their appeals, of course. And generally speaking, in most situations, there's some bleed over, especially in matters where it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I tend very strongly to be an ideologue. That's just kind of the way that I'm wired. If I find out that there is a proper way to hang toilet paper, or if there is a proper way to peel a banana, or whatever, I'll do it that way. And pretty much all the time I will do it that way if I can manage. Now, I'm not going to, in matters that are of no consequence, like the examples that I just named, I'm not going to bend over backward to do it. I'm not going to obsess over things that are ultimately pointless. But nevertheless, doing things properly, having the right procedure, is important to me. And if I have to exert myself a little bit harder, or put myself out a little bit more, generally I'm willing to do that. Again, within certain parameters anyway. Instead, we're not going to talk about politics here today, but I do want to talk about the Bible. And I want to talk about the way that we approach the Bible with regard to pragmatism or ideology and see where we line up. And I think you're going to find that I'm going to have a very strong leaning one way, and I'm going to try to convince you to lean that way as well, of course. Anyway, let's talk about our definitions a little bit. A pragmatist is ultimately someone who is more concerned with results than procedure. And I tried to give you some examples from pop culture or from your knowledge base in other kind of quarters to kind of put this in perspective a little bit. When I think of pragmatists, one of the first people I think of is Batman. Someone who doesn't really have any rules, who doesn't really have any set procedures. All he's interested in is clearing Gotham of crime. And so he's going to do that. And if it means invading people's privacy or it means breaking the rules or breaking the laws himself, he'll do whatever he has to do. And there are many, many heroes or characters anyway. Maybe you wouldn't want to call him a hero, but there are many characters. And generally speaking, they're the good guys in the movies or in TV. Dirty Harry is like this back from the 70s. The young ones don't remember who he is. That's okay. Anyway, Jack Bauer from the 24 series. These are people who get things done. And we tend to lionize people like that. We tend to say, you know, that person is willing to go out there and break a few rules and break a few heads and do whatever it takes to get the job done, which works as long as their philosophy is the same as our philosophy. You know, if they agree with us as far as ideology, as far as theory, then this works pretty well. When they disagree with us, of course, not nearly so much. An ideologue is someone who is wedded to a philosophy irrespective of what results may arise. Someone who has a way the world is supposed to work. And everything that they do is focused in that direction. From ancient history, Brutus is somebody like this. Someone who believes in democracy. Someone to the point where he is going to assassinate the tyrant Julius Caesar. You know, generally speaking, murder would be a bad thing. But because democracy is so important in Brutus's mind, as well as the other conspirators, he's willing to put himself out there. This is his philosophy. Very similar to Osama bin Laden, who you may have heard of a little bit more often in recent days than Brutus. But anyway, the same kind of thing. Someone who is driven by a philosophy. Lots of times you disagree with the philosophy, of course, and that makes the ideologues kind of scary. They get very, very obsessed, as it were, and there's no reasoning with them. There's no talking them down. That you can't say, but if you take that approach, such and such is going to happen. They don't care about such and such. What such and such doesn't matter. They're wedded to their ideology. If you don't know the name Will Cain, then you need to get reacquainted with classic Westerns. Will Cain is the protagonist in the classic Western High Noon, played by Gary Cooper, someone who is the marshal in town, and it is his job to protect the town from this invading band of bad guys. And the town has quit. The town doesn't want him to protect the town. He has surrendered his post. He's gotten married that very morning, and he's about to take, you know, go off on his own life, separate from the town. And yet he stays. This is who he is. He's determined to do the right thing, even if nobody wants him to do the right thing. The town doesn't want him to do the right thing. His wife doesn't want him to. Nobody does. Certainly the bad guys don't. And nevertheless, he's going to do it because that's who he is. That's an ideologue in motion, basically. What it basically comes down to is the idea of compromise. Are you going to be willing to compromise? The pragmatist is all about compromise. The pragmatist wants to find a plan that's going to work. And if it means whittling away at this or that or whatever, yes, absolutely, he's going to be compromising. There is no compromise with the ideologue. The ideologue is going to go his way, and that's all that there is to it, basically. Well, let's talk about the Bible and where people, what kind of categories people will fall into with regard to pragmatists and ideologues. The pragmatist that I'd like to focus on, first of all, is one that we read about a few moments ago from 1 Kings 16, not 1 Kings 6. And we read the text how Ahab made a deal. He cut a deal with the Sidonians. And in so doing, married Jezebel, which created problems in and of itself. But really, the bigger issue was that he brought Baal worship into the northern kingdom of Israel. And not just the worshiping of idols. Israel had worshipped idols at least since Jeroboam's day, and probably earlier than that. That's not the main issue. Ahab made it state policy to worship idols. He built an idol temple, apparently, and focused on idol. Now, he didn't give up on Jehovah worship, apparently, but nevertheless, he made it official and encouraged other people to do this as well. His marriage to the Sidonian princess connected him with their gods, with their culture. This is about getting things done. He sees enemies on the horizon. He goes out and finds a solution. Is it the solution that his philosophy backed up? No, it's not. But it's a philosophy that worked. It's an approach that worked. And so therefore he was able to work around, as it were, the little quirks, you might say, placed upon him by the law of Moses. He accepted the unfortunate reality of Israel's weakness and of Assyria's strength. He knows that there is trouble, and so he's going to do what he has to do to avail himself of the best option, to take care of his situation. In this situation, of course, make an alliance with the Sidonians. Now, it may be significant that it is in this context, if you remember reading at the very end of 1 Kings chapter 16, that Jericho is rebuilt in these days. And if you remember the story, when Joshua led the conquest of Jericho, he pronounced a curse upon Jericho by inspiration, apparently, saying that the city would not be built again except at the loss of the firstborn and youngest born of the one who built the city. Well, this one took it upon himself to resurrect Jericho in this time. And sure enough, he lost his son and lost his youngest son, his oldest and youngest son, in the process. And I've always read that as just being one of those, what looks on the surface like a horrible, horrible accident that happened to fulfill prophecy. It may not be that. Idol worship, as you're aware, got to be very, very ugly. It got to be just a gruesome kind of thing. Some of them involving human sacrifices, particularly the sacrifice of children. It may be that Joshua's curse and the fulfillment that we see in Ahab's day was literally true. That this was part of an institution ceremony. That this man was willing to kill his children to build up the city and presumably make some money, make a name for himself. Well, he made a name for himself, all right. Not the kind of name that hopefully you and I would want anyway. I'll give you another example. In Exodus chapter 32, as Moses is up on the mountain receiving the law of Moses, his brother Aaron is kind of minding the store for his younger brother. And the people get a little antsy. They get frustrated at Moses' long delay. And so they want to, they're starting to cause trouble. They're thinking about maybe going back to Egypt. They think they've been abandoned by this Moses and this God that he was talking about that they still don't understand very well. And so Aaron kind of takes the bull by the horns, if you'll pardon the expression, and accepts the reality, the unfortunate, deplorable, certainly, reality of the people's rebellion, and tries to combat a volatile situation the best way that he can come up with. We got to keep these people here. We got to keep them mollified. We got to keep them in place. Well, here's what we'll do. We'll build this golden calf. That'll keep them busy. If throw a party, that'll keep the kids occupied, right? So we'll have this golden calf. We'll have a ceremony around the golden calf, and it works. It absolutely works. There's no talk about leaving now. The people are very, very excited to stay exactly where they are. They rose up to eat and drink and sat down to play, or sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. The text says. Well, that's pretty much it. That's sin in a nutshell. Well, this wasn't permitted, of course, from the very beginning. They didn't know much about God, but at least they knew this: "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make any to yourselves any graven images." They knew that. Aaron knew that, and nevertheless, he violated these rules, and in the process, probably violated considerably more of them as well, because that was the best solution that he could put his hands on at the time. So he was willing to compromise his values for the what you might call the greater good. Now, I think that we would agree that approaches like this, approaches like Ahab's, approaches like Aaron's, may have a semblance of wisdom. They may have a semblance of common sense, you might say, about them. They got the job accomplished that they were trying to accomplish, but they did so at the expense of their faith. They did so at the expense of proper, decent worship to the God of heaven. And so I think that we would agree that pragmatism in this context was a mistake. They should not have been doing these kind of things. Now, that being said, let's talk about some ideologues, or ideologues. A Bible ideologue, these are the people that we're accused of being oftentimes. The one that I'm accused of being. Well, you're just so closed-minded, you're so rigid, you're so caught up in your, we need to live in the real world. How many times have you heard people say that? You know, we need to live in the real world. Well, like we have an option, What kind of world were you suggesting that we might live in other than the real world? They're talking about this world here in the flesh, of course. And when they say live in the real world, what they mean is accept realities. Accept what appear to be unchangeable situations. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be idealistic about such things. And we have a Bible precedent for this. In the story of Ahab, of course, we also have his counterpart, Elijah, who, by pretty much any standard, would seem to be a radical. Maybe even a terrorist. Here's a man who is shaking up the peace, who takes it upon himself. He didn't go to committee with this. He certainly didn't go to Ahab with this. He says, "I follow the God of heaven. God of heaven is not pleased with this, and so therefore, we're going to have 3 years without rain." Curses, for practical purposes, every single person in the northern kingdom. Horrible consequences, including consequences upon people who did not ask for this, who were not worshiping Baal. He's going to be told later on there's 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal, whether that's a real number or a symbolic number, I'm not sure. But clearly there are people who philosophically line up with Elijah. And he's cursing all of them. He's taking it upon himself to bring this disaster upon the people, because he realizes that the spiritual point that he's trying to make is the only real consideration. And yes, there are going to be horrible, horrible consequences for doing what God says. Nevertheless, doing what God says is ultimately the only consideration. And because of that, we're going to find a way to deal with the consequences. Now, Elijah himself suffered. He was forced out into the wilderness to live by this brook and feed himself with whatever the ravens happened to bring him. That's a mark of God's providence, of course. I'm not sure I'd care to fight a bird for a scrap of meat, but if I did, I'd probably lose, right? The birds have wings, I don't, etc. And when the brook dries up, he has to leave the country entirely. Who knows what kind of consequences came to the other people? Nevertheless, he felt in his mind that this was an important stand that he had to make. John the Baptist is another one. We read the story in Matthew chapter 14 and verses 1 through 12. It's actually put in the Matthew timeline after John is already dead. But Herod is looking back at these days. He's looking at the ministry of Jesus. He's looking at this chaos in his mind that Jesus has created. And he thinks John the Baptist has come back from the dead, either literally or figuratively. And then Matthew tells the story, and you probably know the story fairly well, of John getting in the face, figuratively if not literally, of Herod, and saying it is not legal, it is not right for you to have your brother's wife. He's run off and taken his, literally, his brother's wife, taken him for her for his own wife, living in sin, living in adultery. Herod's not a Jew. Herod's not an Israelite. He's a Edomite. Edomian is what they call him, which is basically a New Testament version of an Edomite. The Edomites don't have any real track record as far as serving God goes. Herod is going through the motions, at least, of serving God, historians tell us. But at his core, he's a pagan. He's not genuinely converted to God at all. And yet, John goes out of his way to antagonize this one. Partly, no doubt, because he wants to be seen as someone who is standing up against the evils of his day. Partly because Herod's being a bad example to the nation of Judah, or the nation of Israel, to the Jews, and John's not going to stand for that. He winds up losing his head over this, and we mean that literally. He's in prison first, and Herod's content to leave him in prison. He's not causing any trouble in prison, and that's good enough. But that's not good enough for Herodias, the wife in question. She says, no, we're not going to have that. And ultimately, she sets up this scenario with her daughter, and we're not going to get down that road too much. But anyway, Herod decides he's going to kill John after all. This is the extreme that John was willing to go to in pursuit of a principle, in pursuit of a spiritual point. Because of his faith, he was driven to do something very unreasonable that had horrific consequences for himself. Nevertheless, it was the right thing to do in his mind, and therefore he pursued that. Stephen is another example of this. You remember the evangelist Stephen, who is one of the seven that's appointed to take care of widows in Acts chapter 6. And very quickly he acquires a reputation, if he didn't have it already, for standing for the gospel and vigorously standing for Jesus in the synagogues among his fellow Jews. And before too long, he's called up on charges before the Sanhedrin, and his rhetoric gets even worse. And when he's called on it, it gets worse than that. It's almost like he is antagonizing these people. And I've heard gospel preachers even suggest, well, you know, if he'd come down a little bit, he might have survived this and gone on to preach some more for years to come after this. Well, maybe so. We don't know. We'll never know, of course, at this point. The point, though, from Acts chapter 7 is that Stephen saw evil. He saw murder, essentially, the murder of Jesus. He saw people who were unwilling to stand up for it, and not only that, were unwilling to deal with the consequences of that murder with reference to the gospel. And he calls them stiff-necked and uncircumcised. You call a Pharisee or a Sadducee uncircumcised, that's about as bad as it gets. You're saying you're a Gentile, basically, when you're saying that. They didn't take it very well. They stoned him right there on the spot. Well, was that the right thing for Stephen to do? Well, it was the idealistic thing for him to do. It was the ideologue in him, standing up for doing the right thing and only dialing up the rhetoric when the message started hitting close to home. He could have been pragmatic about it. He could have been practical, as it were, and lived to preach another day. He didn't do that. And generally speaking, I think we honor Stephen for that. We say he's someone who stood by his principles. He believed in what he was doing, and the results of it really didn't matter. And we can talk about some other examples as well. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are classic examples of this. You know, if we get thrown in the fire furnace, we get thrown in the fire furnace, whatever. We're not concerned about the results. We're concerned about our faith. We're concerned about our connection to God. That's what we're going to do. And whatever results come, we're going to have to deal with the results. Now, what we need to do as Christians is find a way to tap into that idealism. tap into this ideological way of looking at things. Because it's very easy for us to be pragmatic. And I said, yeah, I was going to choose sides, and obviously I have. You can, if you choose, go through life in your faith, use your faith pragmatically, and be a Christian when it's convenient, be a Christian when it serves your short-term purposes, and when it doesn't, I'm just going to make some compromises here or there. You can do that if you want to. Lots of people do. You might argue that most people do who claim to be Christians. That doesn't make it the right thing to do, though. What we need to do is follow Bible examples and trust the ideology, trust the philosophy that God has given us, and live in faith. Live in confidence that God is watching over us. And the fact that God is controlling these things, that God is watching over us, ought to give us a great deal of confidence, as it did Stephen. As Stephen, at his, what you and I would probably call his darkest hour, finds his greatest epiphany of faith, seeing Jesus at the right hand of God, looking into heaven itself, essentially. What a marvelous thing that would have been. And I would imagine that Stephen would have told you that was his greatest moment at that point, the moment he was most connected to God, as it were. We, as Christian ideologues, we need to pursue his holiness. This is the ultimate goal for us. Hebrews chapter 12 mentions our holiness and this drive for holiness that is absolutely necessary for us. We touched on this, I believe, in our Bible study this morning in the back classroom. They disciplined us, that is our physical fathers, disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us, God disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. Now, we could go on and on about holiness. But what it basically amounts to is a behavior pattern, a thought process that attaches us to God. The sanctified ones, the ones who are pulled apart from the world and given this new purpose and this new identity. This is who we are now. And what matters to us is pursuing holiness. Our lesson in the back was about discipline. And we pointed out from various passages that discipline is necessary to achieve certain physical goals. If you want to win the gold medal, or if you want to whatever your goal happens to be. You have to work at it. You have to put yourself out. You have to accept some negative consequences. Well, if we're going to be disciplined for God's holiness, we ought to realize that there are going to be negative consequences. And if we get in the habit of excusing ourselves when our service to God becomes inconvenient, when it starts hurting a little bit too much, we're never going to get to where God wants us to be. And we very well may endanger our salvation itself. Nothing that interferes with this pursuit of holiness can be tolerated by the Christian. We have to get rid of all of those things, even if it costs us something, even if it costs us everything. His word is the ultimate truth. You know, there's all kinds of competing forces out there. There are competing philosophies. Well, yeah, the Bible has a lot of truth in it, and a lot of people will try to rationalize like this. Well, you know, the Bible's a great book. The Quran's a great book. You know, there are a lot of great books out there. Aristotle, Plato, you know, there's Darwin. A lot of people out there who have a lot of good ideas. And I think the best thing to do is to take, you know, bits and pieces from all of these things and kind of cobble together a philosophy that works for me. Well, when you do that, essentially what you're doing is you're taking all the parts of the philosophy that you agree with. So you're not really changing at all, are you? You're not accepting anybody's philosophy. You're just preaching your own philosophy when you do that. We came to Jesus because we believed that he was mightier than us, that he was wiser than us, that his way was going to be better than any way we could have concocted for ourselves. You shall know the truth, he promised us. And the truth will set you free. What a marvelous promise. His truth, his word, is going to set us free. Free from doubt. Free from fear. Free from sin. More than anything else. His word, his truth, is going to do this. Now, there are going to be times when you're going to be called upon to be pragmatic about this. When Bible truth is inconvenient. When it doesn't fit in very well with modern society. when it is objectionable on one level or another. You're making people angry, you're making people upset, you're hurting people's feelings, whatever. And so therefore, we need to bring the Bible up to date, as it were. At least bring Bible philosophy up to date. And we have Christians saying this very same thing with regard to morality, with regard to church government, with regard to very, very fundamental things that are laid out for us in the Scriptures. Are we going to be hard-headed about this? Are we going to be dogmatic about this? The Bible answer is yes. We're going to accept His truth, and we're not going to measure it against our own or someone else's standard of righteousness or decency or truth. His promise is the ultimate motivation. This is what we want. And I realize that you have motivations that compete with this, as do I. You may be motivated to make a lot of money or to have a big family or have a lot of friends or graduate at the top of your class or whatever it happens to be. And all that's fine in and of itself. But the ideologue is laser focused. You know, how many times do you think Osama bin Laden sat around in his cave philosophizing about the best way to educate his children? Such things as that. That's not a concern for a person like that. She is always focused on the task at hand. And, you know, without trying to hold Osama bin Laden up as too much of a role model here for us, we need that same kind of focus. We need to be laser focused on Jesus and His goal, His promises.
Read with me in 2 Peter chapter 1. Peter writes this epistle to his contemporaries, but it resonates with us as well. Back up to verse number 2. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord, seeing that His divine power has granted us everything pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge. That kind of goes back to the last point. The true knowledge of Him who called us by His own glory and excellence. For by these He has granted to us His precious and magnificent promises, so that by them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world by lust. Now what he's saying here is, we have to trust in Jesus, that He has made us promises. And if we will trust in Him, apart from circumstances, apart from the consequences that may be coming to us and even do come to us in the short term, trust in those promises because we believe in what Jesus is promising us. That's what we want. That is our ideal. That is our goal. And if Jesus takes us a road that is objectionable in some way, that's painful, that hurts our feet, that hurts our feelings, whatever, that seems to trample over other people's feelings, we're not happy about that. We don't take any special joy in that. But that's not the issue, is it? The issue is, are we going to believe in His promises? Do we want what He has set out before us? And if we do, are we willing to go the way that He has told us to go to achieve those promises? Everything in life is run through that filter. Now, I'm preaching to something of a closed group here. If you take this gospel to the streets, you talk to average people out there on the street, including people who claim to revere Jesus, who claim to follow Jesus, they're going to look at you like you're a nut. You know, how can you be so dogmatic? How can you be so closed-minded about these things? Because I believe. I'm a true believer. I have bought into the philosophy of Jesus Christ as Lord. That has implications for my life. And I'm prepared to accept those implications. I'm not always the best that I could be or should be at following through with this. But this is the life that I've chosen. And I presume this is the life that you've chosen as well, because you're here after all. Now, when that choice, when that ideology begins to become uncomfortable, when it is inconvenient, when it costs us something or hurts somebody else, does it become time for us to make a deal? Does it become time for us to compromise? Or does it become time for us to double down on our commitment? Say, you only thought that I was devoted to Jesus before. Wait until you see tomorrow. Those kind of people have always been brushed off.
Those are the kind of people like Elijah and John that wind up, you know, out there in the wilderness wearing weird clothing and doing weird things, not having a lot of friends. I'm not going to lie to you about this. Jesus is going to cost you some stuff. You may wind up living out in the wilderness in camel's hair and eating locusts and wild honey. It hadn't been my experience, but I wouldn't rule it out. It's happened before, obviously. And what if it happens to us? What if this is the consequence that comes from being unilaterally, wholeheartedly devoted to Jesus? Well, that's when we find out what our ideology is and how willing we are to live and die with that ideology. An awful lot of people, you can read about them in books, you can read about a few of them in the Bible. A lot of people gave their life for this ideology. That may seem supremely unreasonable to a lot of people out there, and most people out there in the world. That may seem supremely unreasonable to you and me. Nevertheless, this is what they did, because this is the God that they served. And they didn't serve him because he brought nice things to them, or he made their life comfortable. They served him because of the promises. Always keeping the future of heaven in mind. That is what our focus must be. And if we do maintain that focus, if we maintain that heaven-centered existence, if everything that we do washes through that filter, we may or may not suffer for it in this life. But I guarantee you this, you'll be rewarded for it in the next life. In the next life, you'll receive the fulfillment of all of these promises, which are more magnificent than anything that you and I could ever craft out for ourselves in this life. This is the assurance that God gives, not the assurance that I give. Don't follow after me. Don't follow after the elders here. Don't follow after this church. Follow after Jesus and go where he tells you to go, and have confidence that you, like a sheep in his fold, are going to be rewarded, are going to be blessed because of this association. If we can help you achieve that, if we can help you focus on spiritual things, if we can listen to your confession of fault, perhaps, or even put you in water for remission of sins and allow you to begin this life of devotion to Jesus Christ. If in anything we can help you with regard to these things, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing to encourage you at this time.